You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Welcome. And today my guest is David Grossman. He's the author most recently of The Zigzag Kid and the author of several novels before it, The Smile of the Lamb, Sea Under Love, The Book of Intimate Grammar. I'm very happy to be able to announce to my listeners that The Zigzag Kid, although it has been published as a book like any of his others, is in fact a bar mitzvah book, a book written for his sons when they were about to be bar mitzvahed. And so much of the writing about the book, which has criticized it for its lack of adult constructions, are ignoring a basic fact that this is a world seen through a child's eyes. Now, it seems to me that every significant writer, or at least the ones I care about, have the impulse to tell fables or children's stories. Even Nabokov translated Alice in Wonderland. Kafka is always creating the investigations of a dog, or Josephine the Mouse Singer. And there's an interest in straddling the world of the child and the world of greater outside despair. This is this contact with childhood, what makes these writers in their way special. So I wanted to begin by asking you, what were you telling your sons?
Shalom. When my elder son turned almost bar mitzvah, I thought I want to write a book for him. Since I wrote a book about time of adolescence, and I know it's quite fragile period in our life, I wanted to give him a book, a cheerful one, that would accompany him when he enters this tunnel of adolescence. And I wrote Zigzag, The Zigzag Kid, trying to show him not only the more, how do you say, anguished aspects of our life, but the more cheerful, even with those explosive energies that exist, the alchemy of being a child and becoming a man.
I'm so pleased because implicit in this, although it never says so, the author is telling his story, Noni is the narrator, 27-some years after the fact, after his own bar mitzvah day, and I assumed all along that the ultimate ear for the book is the child.
Yeah.
It's a funny thing, then, to have a book emerge in America as if it were people are expecting the Magic Mountain from you and they're getting the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you know?
Yes. However, I must say that the book was published now in several countries, and almost everywhere it had the same course. Even in places where it started as a book for children, immediately it crossed to be a book for adults as well, as it happened in Israel. And I think that the most common reaction to the book that I hear is that adults come to me and say, hey, this book reminded us of the taste of reading when we were young. So I did not intend that to be. As I said, I wrote it for my children, and I recall very vividly the process. When I finished writing, the process of reading it to them, which this was something so unique in my experience. You know, the book now has, I think, 28 chapters. It had 35 chapters when I started reading it to them, and they just butchered it. I mean, I think I'm now immune totally in front of any critic because what I suffered in these 5 weeks that I read them the story. And it was a wonderful experience. You know, this hour when you read a story to a child before he goes to sleep is always it's a beautiful story. I mean, you send him into the night with a literary kiss on the cheek. It's good. And their reaction were so important for me.
Now, it seems to me that the book begins with a question in Hebrew, Mi ani, who am I? And that this, in the week before his bar mitzvah, there are many different answers that Noni is being provided. He's being given, on the one hand, by his father, a group of clowns and magicians. The father is telling him, you're a child. He's being sent to his uncle to be given a lecture about adult responsibility, and the uncle is saying, you're an adult. But by accident, for him, he thinks by accident, he meets a grandpa on the train who tells him, you are an artist and an outlaw, essentially. And when the boy asks, who am I? The grandfather takes out a picture, you know, a picture being worth, what, 1,000 words. And so the book proceeds to tell us who Noni is and who he doesn't know he's been. This seems to me, you know, Oedipus, yes?
Well, I think that the book deals a lot with Oedipus. Yes, there is a major scene in the book when Noni decides he will be the first Israeli and Jewish bullfighter. And he wages a corrida against a poor cow in the neighborhood, yes. And I think that in this scene, well, this is the essence of the Oedipus complex there, because the cow, which he thinks to be a bull, is his father. But let's don't go psychology, because this is other people should do it. But yes, you are right. But one thing I must correct you. We must not let our listeners know that the person that he meets on the train is his grandpa, because Noni himself does not know that. He meets someone, he thinks it's accidentally, and he's fascinated by him, because this old gentleman is an international criminal. And Noni doesn't know why this gentleman is so keen to accompany him. Well, later, after they hijack the train, he starts to realize who this person is. He knows his name. He knows nothing about their affinity. And half of the book, Noni is kidnapped by this old man, but it's very strange. He wants to be kidnapped because he realizes that this old man has something very important to tell him. The story that everyone tried to keep secret from him all his life, the story about his dead mother. And so there is a strange situation in which he tries to stick to his kidnapper and to run away from the people who wants to save him from this kidnapper.
Well, one of the reasons I think that readers are saying that it reminds them of what reading was like when they were children is that although it is true that the identity of this Felix is a secret from Noni, the reader, as an adult, knows nearly immediately. And it is that fun of being in the world in which, as a reader, you're being told that you can't guess what you already do know. You know, most times the author would be working very hard to keep these cards very far up the sleeve and concealed. But the joke of this book is, in a sense, that there are no secrets from the reader.
Yeah, only Noni doesn't know. And also children do not know necessarily. I remember one of the most vivid experiences that I had while reading it to my children was there is a point in which all the plot changes, you know, and suddenly Noni realizes that this old criminal that accompanies him is his grandfather, that it's very essential for his own life. And then all the plot falls into its place, but in a different way, as if you have a jigsaw puzzle of a parrot and suddenly you build a jigsaw puzzle of a fish out of the same pieces. And I remember my children were in bed listening to this story, and I started to feel the vibrations of tension when they started to realize. And then I said, yes, he is his grandfather. And they teared the page out of my hand. It was an output of a computer then. And they start to jump on it and crush it. And they couldn't believe that their father deceived them in such a way. And, you know, something, I must tell you something. Everything that I got through my literary career, you know, all this recognition, good reviews and bad reviews, nothing was so immediate and authentic and important to me as this wrinkled page that is still hanging in my working room.
Now, it seems to me, then also, that another thing that critics have missed because they haven't been the key signature hasn't been given to them, you know. So they don't know the rhythms and the tones. It seems to me that most of the chapters end with refrains, a series of questions like the Firkashas, like the four questions, where Noni re-summarizes what it is he thinks he knows and what it is he has to learn. And this is like the chorus of a song, essentially. Yes?
I will add nothing. I mean, just, no, but it's really a good feeling to be read the way you read it, yes. Yes, I think that... I try to do it as a kind even of a lullaby, this story, yes, because it was meant to be read to children before sleep. And this inner rhythm that you described is exactly what I wanted to achieve here.
Now, it seems to me that when I saw in the first book jacket, I think it was For Sea Under Love was the first book published in America, that your wife is a psychologist, I said,
I quote him.
But it does seem to me, when you said before, let others go to the psychological reasons, that it's not necessarily others. They're on your mind. This is a book of instruction to some extent, but it doesn't want to name its instruction quite directly.
I think if you write a book from psychological point of view, it reduces a book to not even psychology, but psychologism. I think you turn the human being, not only the literary characters, into machines. And I try not to work this way. Whatever I wrote was analyzed heavily by psychologists and psychoanalysts, and I am always invited to go into lecture to these people. It always surprises me. Of course, I'm aware of psychology, but the main motivation is to tell a story. And sometimes when people start to analyze my stories and to explain to me what I meant, I'm surprised. I'm just surprised. My energies of writing are totally different, and even after having written the book, they are not necessarily decoded to me. And this is the fun, or this is the sting of the method. This is the urge of writing, because I believe that all my life I'll continue to write more and more in order to understand. You know, there are people who write because they want to express something. I write more than anything. I write because I need to understand that there are so many important things in my life, in the relationship that I have with other people, that I tell myself, you know, maybe later you will write about it, you will understand it more. I just feel that unless I write about something, I do not understand it.
But there is the implication, for instance, in Sea Under Love and the Book of Intimate Grammar, that history is the unconscious of a child in Israel, that a child growing up who is not told about the Holocaust but hears things from relatives, has got to assemble a relationship to authority that's quite terrifying, that the Six-Day War that forms the background to the other book is again the world that the child cannot completely understand. And so the books, for American readers certainly, attain a peculiar kind of resonance because most of us living far away from Europe and that turmoil do not know the history that becomes the unconscious, the history that terrifies the life of a child growing up in Europe. In other words, the books reveal to us almost inadvertently our ignorance.
Yes, when you asked that, I thought to myself, is it really so different? The very process of coming of age, is it really so different here or in Israel? I don't know the answer. Maybe there are some things in Israel, because of our history, that makes the discovering of the world more painful. Yes, I just think, you know, in my younger my young daughter turned 5 now, and she started to ask me about the Nazis. Yes, because it was the Memorial Day for the Holocaust, for the Shoah. And I felt I don't want even to tell her, because I don't want her to be infected by the information of the atrocities, that once this possibility is formulated in a pure mind, she will be infected in a way. And I thought that, you know, in age that parents sometimes are bewildered to reveal their children facts of life, we have to deal with facts of death first. And of course, it has its influence.
Yeah. I was just speaking to Art Spiegelman recently, who told me similarly that his children are not given mouse to read. He expects someday, yes, that they may, you know, learn about their grandfather. But at this point, it's something that he is engaged with. And part of the engagement is needing the page to tell a story that he would not tell his children.
You see, I think that living in Israel makes this exposure to the difficulties and the tragic sense of life makes it inevitable. It's everywhere. It's the reality there. When I say reality, is also the past. The reality and the past is like an acid that eats through every protective coating, and in that sense, maybe it is more difficult for a child to construct his world and to decode all those silences and fragments of horrible things that he keeps hearing. In See Under Love, I decided to choose a child as a main protagonist in the first part, the Momik. He raises the Nazi beast. He keeps hearing all the time this expression, the Nazi beast. This is how Nazism was referred to when I was a child. And also today, you can hear every day the Nazi beast. It's an idiom. And he is so frightened by it and by the whispers and the silences and the secrets that he decides to raise such a beast in the cellar under the apartment of his parents and to change its ways.
I'm speaking to David Grossman, the author most recently of The Zigzag Kid, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. No, these issues seem to me to be very pertinent, because living as you do, there are many things that are, in a sense, expected of you that are not expected of other writers. I mean, it seems to me that the nightmare of the Israeli writer when he comes to talk about his novels is to have to talk about the Palestinians and to have that as an overlay, essentially, as if everyone's eyes have been bewitched. There is no such thing as an Israeli writer who is not dealing with this circumstance. Yeah. So freedom from history must be very difficult for a writer to attain. A writer is like a child.
Yeah, it is difficult. Freedom not only from history, but freedom from reality is very difficult. To write in Israel in nowadays or in the last years, it is very, very difficult to enclose yourself and to go to other realities. It's almost impossible. I wrote, besides those novels, I wrote 2 documentaries about the Palestinians and Israelis, and I did it. And I think this helped me to purify the fiction from politics. And because there is such a danger that politics would infiltrate in a too immediate way.
Well, it seems to me, by the way, those 2 books in English are Sleeping on a Wire and Yellow Wind, yes? It seems to me that in the case of Kafka recently, Guy Davenport marvels that the castle seems to anticipate the concentration camp up to the tower at its center. And similarly, too, from another basically apolitical writer, Nabokov is always fleeing from the tyrant and poses the author as a counter-tyrant. And in his first book in English, he says what an author does. Yeah. The tyrant is about to kill his hero, and the author reaches his big hairy hands into the book and saves him. This is the obligation of the author. So in a certain sense, a certain kind of literary writer writes against politics, it seems to me.
You know, when we were talking earlier about psychology, I think we can judge politics, quote-unquote, in the same terms. There is something so narrowing about politics or living political life, about formulating our life the way politics does to us, which I think is outrageous. There is such a tendency to describe everything in clichés and to think clichés until suddenly you feel you are yourself become a cliché in a reality. The reality congeals around you. I think what writers can do, even if they don't write directly about politics, is to break this congealness, yes? Is to show themselves at first that there are so many nuances and delicacies of nuance in every situation, in every human position.
Yes, exactly. I did not mean to write as if politics did not exist, but to show the areas of the human soul that may be avoided in the course of the blaring blatancy of political negotiation.
And especially if you live in a very violent area, when there is almost an existential need, if you want to survive, to suspend part of the soul. Yes, not to approach them, because if you approach them, it's too painful to see what you are doing, what others are doing to you, in what horrible reality you have to live and to raise children. So in that sense, literature can redeem those parts in the soul and just bring them back alive, to revitalize them, because I'm always afraid that parts in the soul, both in the personal and in the national psyche, that are suspended, it's irreversible to go back there, to become human being again.
Well, it seems to me, I've met several friends who are Serbian and who are not, you know, they are the literary people of conscience in Serbia. And what I notice is that they fall silent, that the response to a society become monstrous is action on the one side and silence on the other. The need for imaginative writing, for writing to remind readers of the solutions to be found within the imagination, that the human spirit has to be maintained and cultivated there, seems to me to be the neglected solution that more political critics do not understand. They seem to think of imagination as evasion rather than protection.
You're right. I think, for me, so many things are natural because of the situation that I live, because I feel that the language is permanently polluted by reality and by politicians. And I always think that writers are people who feel claustrophobic in words that other people used. And that's why it's almost a physical urge, you know, to break this suffocation and to give your own words and again, to salvage this reality that was frozen or congealed. And this is why I wrote Yellow Wind and Sleeping on a Wire. And this is why I wrote almost all my books, I think. You know, all my books almost deal with the individual that has to face a kind of an outer arbitrariness which paralyzes him. And I know it. I know how easy it is to be paralyzed by outer circumstances and how governments, or not only governments, you know, sometimes there is a clash between the soul and the body. Yes, the Book of Intimate Grammar is about a child that tries to rebel against his body. He just cannot bear the thought that which he sees himself as a sparkle of light, of inventiveness, of imagination, that he would be subjugated to the bureaucracy of the glands, as he call it, when he starts to mature, and he is suspended from the stream of the course of coming of age. And my way, or I think the way of almost all my main protagonists, is by telling stories, is by finding new words to just to liberate themselves, to feel this inner freedom.
I wanted to ask you about what you feel comes into your prose, because it is in Hebrew. What is the quality of the language that marks your work?
Well, I think when you read it in Hebrew, you get probably a mixture of very modern Hebrew, very updated Hebrew, but with quite a lot of ancient layers of this language. And not only this language, I think that in my books, sometimes I try to create this music of both Hebrew and Yiddish to see how they can mingle. Yes, because sometimes people tend to think that there is a clash or a war between these two languages. And I, maybe because I had a very sweet grandmother who spoke Yiddish and, you know, supplied me with so much Yiddish proverbs about everything almost, I felt that I want to infiltrate, or even to be a little subversive in the Hebrew, and to put in this ironic, soft way of speaking that exists in the Yiddish. In general, you know, writing in Hebrew, I see it as a privilege. I'm not, you know, a chauvinist of Israel, but maybe I'm a patriot of the Hebrew, because there is something very special about writing in a language that counts back 4,000 years. You know, sometimes I think that if Abraham, our father, sat with us to dinner, he would be able to understand at least half of the conversation today, and this is something. And since we are talking about language, I regard language as a kind of a national archive of a people, because it preserves all the residues of the people, you know, the psychology and the sexuality and the violence and imagination and self-image and humor. Everything remains in the language like residues on the riverbed after the generation have passed. And if you know many of those layers of the Hebrew, if you can go back to the Mishnah and the Talmud and interweave them into very modern, very wild Hebrew and slang of the army, if you can stir all these together, the current and the subcurrent and the eternity and immediacy, I think you create something that I at least need desperately today in Israel, which is identity.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Additional production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse, mouth time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.